I think one of the issues that individuals within buildings, whether it's residential or commercial, is that you are not necessarily in control of these kind of cleaning or air quality or any of these kind of things are not under your direct control. So whereas in your own living space, you can, you know, clean your bathroom as often as you choose, and you can maintain this environment that you feel is, you know, optimized for your own health, both because of COVID-19, but also, you know, all of the other aspects of your health. When we're in these larger buildings or buildings that we can't control, there is a sense, there is the need to trust the people who are doing the cleaning, the people who are setting the filtration rates or the air quality. So that's, again, comes back to this trust piece, that it's going to be so important that the individuals within the building who aren't in control of these strategies that are necessary in order to mitigate the risk of the spread of coronavirus, that they communicate what they are doing and they do it in a way that's very open and transparent.
This is 3P Theory, the podcast for AEC professionals seeking to elevate their knowledge on green building strategies and practical design collaboration for sustainable mindsets, bringing you changemakers, innovators, and sustainable leaders who have positively impacted the industry. It's time to get inspired, motivated, and fired up to take action towards a greener planet. Here's your host, Mike Brown.
Well, welcome to the 3P Theory podcast. We have a special guest here today that's going to talk about some of the transition that's going on in the workplace due to COVID-19 and some of the strategies around really being able to prepare the workforce and prepare occupants to, you know, go back to life as normal, although we don't necessarily know what that time frame is going to look like, but really just kind of looking at the larger picture and where building owners and managers, tenants, along with other occupants can really come together to find a solution that will make the workplace, quote unquote, safe again. And obviously being able to maintain health and wellness along the way. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, I'll first start off. Tell me a little bit about how you got into this role and kind of some of the things that got you interested in this particular field.
Sure. So my education was as an architect, actually. And I did that for a number of years before really transitioning to be a real estate developer. So it's kind of funny how you go from being a developer to what I'm doing now. But there was this 2008 crash in the real estate market, which we thought that was bad. So interesting perspective. And at that point, I actually joined the Bloomberg administration. So Michael Bloomberg was then mayor of New York City. And I started running a couple of different programs within the administration, which really kind of transitioned my interest in just building buildings and designing buildings to really what is the greater function of buildings and our built environment. So first of all, looking at the food system and the built environment, the built environment's role in providing access to healthy food. I ran the Fresh program. And after that, I ran the Active Design program. So that was really looking at how do we use our built environment, our infrastructure investment, buildings, public spaces, to really optimize them for health, for public health. And how do we take the research coming out of public health and translate it into practical design strategies that can be implemented in both existing buildings as well as inform new construction and new investment in infrastructure in New York City. So that was active design, this kind of translation. And this was very popular. The active design guidelines were published actually 10 years ago at this point. And then because of the popularity of this idea, we actually created the Center for Active Design as an independent nonprofit and started really working with the private sector, developers, cities across the US and now globally, that really how do you inform design and development practice with the evidence base and specifically public health. So obviously very relevant to today's situation.
Great. Yeah, that is a unique kind of transition going from architect to developer. And, you know, just I think about it from the engineering side, because I know, at least for the work that I do, there's kind of a unique perspective working within an architecture firm and the things that we kind of do for buildings and strategies. I think one of the things that I always think about as well is just from an engineering standpoint. And more recently, I've also seen a lot from ASHRAE come out in regards to ventilation and air cleaning and things of that nature that could help mitigate some of the issues around viruses and bacteria and just infectious disease control in general. And obviously on top of that, just better air quality, right? You know, we hear about a lot of the buildings that, you know, may not necessarily be managing that properly and maintaining that. And so obviously this is just another way to be able to help move operations and buildings in the right direction for improved health.
I think it's really focused everybody's attention on the role that the operation of buildings plays in underlying health aspects. So I think that, yes, it's interesting to kind of focus on these elements that aren't necessarily top of mind for a lot of folks within buildings, you know, kind of how buildings are operated, how they're managed and so on. So it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I was actually on a call just to give a little insight on a call yesterday with a couple of design leaders from different architecture firms throughout the U.S. And they were talking about just different measures that they've taken in-house to be able to, even as people work virtually, to be able to inform them about obviously just the general resources about COVID-19, infectious diseases, how to keep that under control, and just how also to work from home. There's been, you know, training outside of just general training for learning how to use Zoom and things of that nature around, you know, optimizing your workspace at home and how to manage that. Because I think one of the challenges right now is for a lot of folks that are working from home is being able to maintain a space that kind of limits the blurred lines between working from home and doing actual work and everything else that occurs. I'm fortunate right now not to have any children. So I can understand and know how challenging that is to try and balance caring for them, doing things they need to do for school, if they're still doing that, and continuing your work. And so there's been a lot of just development and training around that. And then, and even with the workplace surveys, one of the things that's been going out continually week after week for our firm is understanding and capturing data around how people are working in terms of productivity and so on and so forth. I'm just interested, what are some of the things that the Center for Active Design has done to really transition during this time period?
Yes, so we're actually going to be putting out somewhat of a hybrid of strategies looking specifically at what you're talking about, like how do you optimize your work environment when your work environment is at home? And, you know, how do we take some of the strategies that were in Fitwell, that are in Fitwell for workplaces, and how do we take some of the residential strategies, bring it together, and then other strategies around optimum mental health? So one thing we feel like isn't being spoken about as much at this point, but what I think will become more and more part of the public dialogue is around mental health and the impact that it's had on anxiety and depression, and obviously social isolation. And so those kind of elements are very important around sleep patterns. Having enough access to daylight is interesting to see the research that you need to have access to daylight during the day in order to maintain a healthy sleep pattern, you know, throughout the course of the work week and so on. So these are the kind of things that I think that we forget perhaps because everything's new. So yes, I've created a standing desk using a pile of recipe books, and I need to remember not to sit for more than, you know, a couple of hours at the most. I need to move on a regular basis. I need to take myself out, you know, during lunchtime, have that my walk while social distancing, of course. You know, there needs to be some structure. There needs to be some routine. Otherwise, as you said, it all kind of blurs into one long day, week. I think most of us can't remember what day of the week it is anyway right now. But it is important. There's a lot of different aspects to maintaining our holistic health. So yes, physical health. So we need to be active. We need to eat healthy food. You need to stay hydrated. All of these things that are so basic, and yet it's incredible how quickly we forget all these things drop off from the way that we're kind of maintaining our daily lives. So it's kind of those daily routines that's what we're always talking about, is daily routines. And right now our daily routines are completely different. And just personally, I don't know whether everyone else has experienced this, but the first week of working remotely, I was exhausted. There was something so tiring about the new routine and having to learn a new routine and staring at the Zoom screen, at the screen all day in our Zoom conferences and stuff. It was really fascinating. It was almost like having a new job or starting a new school. It was this kind of interesting transition, I feel like. But we are going to put out a document that is all backed by research. So, you know, obviously what we do is look at the evidence base and then look at which strategies have the strongest evidence base. So we'll be putting that out, I think, actually later this week. So we can, we'll send that along to you so you can share that with listeners. And then you can kind of see what's a good idea and what is actually backed by evidence. And two might be different or they might be the same.
Awesome. Yeah, no, that'd be great. I know that there's probably a lot of preconceived notions about, you know, what's beneficial and what's not for a lot of people. So I think that'll really help level the playing field and put some validation behind some of those. So I think a lot of people will benefit from that. This isn't something that I may have mentioned before, but I'm just curious. I know that there are probably a few resources out there, and there may even be something that you all are helping develop as well. Is, I wouldn't say a COVID-19 checklist, but I think just saying that broadly, just to get perspective and understand, so people can understand what I mean by that. Is there a document or a resource that's available or that is being developed for, I would say, occupants or tenants that are preparing to go back into the workforce or back into their offices or physical buildings and real estate to begin working again as sort of a checklist where they can say, okay, well, and I would say this for individuals and tenants that do not have the acumen or technical knowledge or background or support to do some of that research and have that kind of communication with their building management or owner of that building to say, am I going back into a safe place? Is this the right time? And things of that nature. I know there's probably a lot of anxiety around that, or will be a lot of anxiety around that once that time comes for people to go back to work.
Sure. And I think I'm going to just jump on what you're saying at the end there first. And I do think that as employers and building managers, building owners prepare for folks to come back to the buildings, that one of the essential pieces will be around building trust, because there will be high levels of anxiety. And the building owners and operators probably have changed some of their policies. And we can kind of talk about which policies specifically address COVID-19, but trust is going to be the thing that needs to be built. So even if you've changed your cleaning protocols, even if you've changed the quality of the air in the building, even if you've upped your filtration rates, even if you've done all of the things that the science is telling us will help to mitigate the spread of infectious disease, you need to communicate that to your tenants. You need to communicate it, if you're an employer, to your employees. And then you need to be incredibly consistent as the building operator in the way that you continue to deliver those services, because people are going to react very quickly and you're going to lose trust incredibly quickly if people see that some of the new protocols are not being met. So I think that everybody's going to be on a very heightened state of anxiety when folks start to go back to buildings. And so I think the trust piece to us is very important. And we know from past epidemics, they were not pandemics, but SARS and MERS, that actually quite a substantial percentage of the population actually suffered from post-traumatic syndrome. So 16% of the populations that were affected by SARS actually suffered from PTSD, with 40% having elevated stress levels afterwards. So very high levels of anxiety and mental health stress after these things have ceased to be maybe an acute problem of like actual infectious disease, you know, spreading. There's still this, you know, kind of mental health issue that needs to be addressed and needs to be at the forefront of the way that we're thinking about this. So that's something I think that's, like I said at the beginning, it's something we talk about and that we care deeply about. But it isn't something I think that is top of mind at the moment. So just to kind of answer the first part of your question, and what is it that building operators should be doing, we have put out a
set of strategies that are the evidence-based strategies around building operations. So they include signage around hand washing, cleaning protocols, you know, kind of what solutions you should be using at a minimum in order to mitigate risk, where you should be cleaning more. So it's kind of high touch areas, bathrooms, kitchens, shared spaces. It's looking at humidity. So the humidity of the space actually influences the ability of infectious disease to transmit within that space. So there are preferred humidity ranges that actually mitigate the spread. And then filtration and air filtration, increasing the fresh air intakes in some instances. Now, we work globally, so obviously that's not an appropriate response in some environments. Mm-hmm. So all of that is there, and we've put that out, and you can actually download that on fitwell.org for free on the resources section. And we will continue to put out these resources. So what we did is we first went back to the evidence base. We went back to, we have a very substantial library of public health research, more than 5,600 peer-reviewed research studies in our libraries. So quite substantial. So we went back and we kind of looked back at the evidence base specifically for infectious disease, which isn't typically our main area of focus. We're more looking at chronic disease, mental health, kind of more overall long-term health outcomes. But we went back, looked at the evidence base specifically at respiratory disease and how to mitigate transmission of respiratory disease. Obviously, there's not a lot of research around COVID-19 because it's so new. So looking kind of more at flu and all the research around those kind of things. So very important that everything be evidence-based. So the first piece that we put out was the operational strategies. We are putting out another set of guidelines specifically for residential buildings. Obviously, they are occupied now and will continue to be occupied. And we're going to keep putting out these resources as we complete them, basically. So we want to make sure that everything has been thoroughly reviewed as far as that it is backed by the evidence base.
Yeah, definitely. I think that will instill a lot of confidence for the people that are operating and living and working in those spaces. You know, I've seen a lot, you know, here in the multifamily properties, in the apartments that I stay at and others that I've been to, have started to change those policies. So it is helping. I think one of the things from commercial office perspective, which even before the pandemic, people have kind of tossed back and forth in terms of workspace layout and floor plans and how one over the other, if we're focusing on open office plan versus enclosed, where you've got tons of, you know, private offices and things of nature, if that, you know, increases your risk of transmitting some of that, or does it become safer if we have those enclosed offices? Obviously, that you'll take some penalties on other things like natural daylight exposure and things of that nature, collaboration, especially in certain industries. Do you think that that's going to shift the design focus to be more to that enclosed private office atmosphere for future design for offices? Or what is your perspective on that?
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? It's an ongoing discussion. I agree. We were having this discussion pre COVID-19, and obviously this is going to just increase the scrutiny on open plan office spaces. And I can certainly see both sides. I can see the pluses and minuses in open plan offices. And I think what I would say, what we advocate for, is really having a choice that you have an area that is open plan and that you have an area in the office that has more private space, really, because some of the big pushback against open plan offices up till now has been around noise and distraction. And yes, it's good for collaboration, but it's not good for like our researchers who are doing heads down work. So I think choice is good. Choice is also good for mental health, because then you don't feel that you have to sit in this space that isn't conducive to what you're trying to do. So choice is what we're looking for, I think, in a workplace. I mean, as it pertains specifically to COVID-19, density does increase, obviously, your mingling and contact with other people. But really, as I already mentioned, the areas where transmission of disease is most likely to happen are actually the high-touch areas, so bathrooms and kitchens and shared spaces, which you're going to have in any kind of office plan layout. So really kind of concentrating the additional cleaning efforts and so on those areas will be first and foremost, regardless of the office layout.
yes, in some open plan office spaces, you probably are closer than 6 feet to each other because the size of the desks obviously has decreased over time. I mean, we don't know the answer to this, but we do work with a lot of partners in the Asia Pacific region. And so what we are beginning to see is kind of this staggered return to work where you don't have everybody going back to the office at the same time, staggered schedules. We're all now pretty comfortable, I would say, probably working remotely. And so we've set up our new strategies and so on for working remotely. So, you know, maybe the new normal is a staggered pattern where everybody isn't in the office at the same time, and therefore you do have less people within the workspace at a given time, and therefore you can continue to have more social distancing. So, but we don't know. I think that all of these things are very much kind of at the experimental level at this point, where different countries, different companies are taking different approaches and seeing what the result of that is. So I think that it is going to be a kind of an interesting transition period. I would say that open plan offices do come with pluses, though, that we care deeply about because of other aspects of health. So yes, COVID-19 has been shocking, and it's something that's kind of brought everyone's attention towards health, but we still have a massive issue around chronic disease. The majority of the population dies of chronic disease, and the risk factors for chronic disease are physical inactivity and obesity and access to healthy foods and all of these kind of things. Mental health, social isolation is one of the leading causes of premature death globally. So we've really got to think about our mental health. So I would say that the open plan office allows, as you mentioned, for more daylight. And daylight is so essential to mental health. It's also really important for tenant and staff satisfaction. So if you want a happy, healthy workforce, you're going to give them access to daylight and views, which is obviously one of the pluses towards open plan offices, is that folks tend to have more access to daylight and views and so on. So, you know, as with most things in life, there are pluses and minuses to both. And I do think it's going to be if your audience are mostly architects and engineers and so on, I think it's a great design challenge. Like, how do we get that balance right? I think there's going to be new normals established. There are going to be new design patterns that people prefer. But I think a lot of it's going to fall onto the policy as well. One of the big pieces that we see as crucial to this is actually having sick leave and encouraging staff to actually not come to work if they're sick. There's a big study around flu that when employees had sick leave, the transmission of flu was actually down by 11.5% compared to employees that didn't have sick leave. So you can have a very big impact on transmission of disease by keeping folks who aren't well out of the workplace in the first place. You know, that's obviously not a design solution, but it's a very effective policy solution that specifically addresses infectious disease. And I just want to touch on, and a lot of folks in the Asia Pacific region are already kind of familiar with this, but I think it's a kind of a little bit more of a new idea to North America, is the idea of the kind of the fever detection and having those kind of machines that you go through in buildings that actually can tell your temperature and so on. And I don't even know if they're legal in the US, but even if they are made legal, I did just want to kind of pull some of the research, because this is a question that's come up now many times from building owners and operators. Can we just put in these machines and feel like we're all good, right? So, and I think that the evidence base isn't looking at COVID-19 because it's too new. So the evidence base that exists is really around SARS and MERS, so different diseases, although similar. And what we see from the research is that the fever detection devices are good. They're good at detecting fever, but detecting a fever isn't good at actually mitigating the spread of infectious disease in most cases at its early stage. So if you have an outbreak of infectious disease, the fever detection isn't good at stopping that, because as we've seen with COVID-19, you may not have a temperature and you may be spreading the disease. You may be asymptomatic and spreading the disease. So at the outbreak of a disease, the fever detection devices aren't shown to actually slow the spread. Where they are good is when a population is in a steady state. They're good at kind of keeping folks who are sick out of the workforce to some extent. And they're actually good for mental health as well. So people derive a certain sense of security from seeing that, which is interesting, especially if they're not that effective at mitigating the spread of infectious disease at the beginning of an outbreak. That trust may soon erode when the evidence base becomes more substantial. So I would say that the research isn't conclusive as far as the fever detection devices for the building operators that are thinking of putting those into their buildings.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, you made me think about also in terms of policies and guidelines is, you know, say if someone were infected, you know, what are the guidelines around, obviously it's going to be different for every building, for getting that person, you know, from their desk out of the building safely in the most efficient way, right? You know, in a kind of a worst case scenario. And I think that's, I mean, you could say that that could be a design issue. It could be more of a operational issue, but it's just something for owners and operators to consider, you know, in those scenarios to make sure that everyone's being safe through that process.
Sure. Yeah. And I think it's something that both building owners as well as employers can really strengthen the culture that tells the people within their buildings that this is a building that really wants to keep you healthy. And one way to keep you healthy is if you're sick to stay home, you know, and that can be done with policy, obviously around sick leave. It can be done through messaging. It can be done through communications as well. And a lot of these things are actually enforced, obviously, by communication. So hand washing, we haven't really talked about hand washing. Hand washing is actually a strategy within the Fitwel certification. And up until now, only 40% of our commercial properties have used that strategy, which seems like such a simple thing to do, right? To just add signage around hand washing. And yet it's not used that often because folks felt like maybe it was a little insulting to tell people how to wash their hands or to wash their hands. I could give you a lot of stats around how many people do wash their hands or did wash their hands for 20 seconds. It's actually 6% of hand washing would meet.
See that, yeah.
they're actually kind of safe amounts of time for COVID-19. But messaging is very effective. It actually does change behavior in a measurable way, whether it's messaging around taking the stairs, whether it's messaging around washing your hands, whether it's messaging around, you know, how you've improved cleaning strategies or, you know, the role that the employees need to take in helping to maintain the new cleaning policies. So I think although it's a simple thing to do, to put up signage and to put up messaging, it is effective. So it shouldn't be overlooked just because it's simple.
Yeah, and it made me think about, it's an unfortunate but also funny situation that occurred. This is right before everything got really serious with the pandemic. And I guess this was an attempt for, you know, that building manager, operator to I guess do their part with prevention. And I'm sure you've been in office buildings or just buildings in general where you've gone to the public restroom and wash your hands and never really gets to the right temperature that it's supposed to, that you need to be able to, at least in the time frame that you're washing your hands. And so I was washing my hands and literally after 2 seconds, I didn't get scalded by the water, but it was very, very hot. And it was kind of an extreme scenario, but it just made me think about psychologically. And I know you mentioned this before, more so for the people that may have contracted the disease and, you know, recovered from it and things of that nature and how that impacts them mentally, even for people that have not contracted the disease or virus or whatnot, you know, how does that impact them from a mental standpoint? And even as people go back into the workforce, should people be, I guess, cautious in a way that it doesn't make them hypersensitive to things that they wouldn't normally see as an issue or a problem due to all that's going on right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's going to be hard for people not to be hyper focused on these things. I think it's already happened. You know, our offices are in New York City. You know, somebody coughs walking down the street, everybody's head swivels around. I think if people aren't washing their hands in the bathroom, I wouldn't be at all surprised if people start to say something. You know, those kind of things, I would imagine that behavior will change in response to this. And actually, the surveys around PTSD following SARS weren't just the people who had had it. It was the whole population that was, you know, part of the geography that had it. So high levels of, I mean, PTSD is a very extreme level of apprehension and people feeling helpless and so on around how to respond to this. I think one of the issues that individuals within buildings, whether it's residential or commercial, is that you are not necessarily in control of these kind of cleaning or air quality or any of these kind of things are not under your direct control. So whereas in your own living space, you can, you know, clean your bathroom as often as you choose and you can maintain this environment that you feel is, you know, optimized for your own health, both because of COVID-19, but also, you know, all of the other aspects of your health. When we're in these larger buildings or buildings that we can't control, there is a sense, there is the need to trust the people who are doing the cleaning, the people who are setting the filtration rates or the air quality. So that's, again, comes back to this trust piece, that it's going to be so important that the individuals within the building who aren't in control of these strategies that are necessary in order to mitigate the risk of the spread of coronavirus, that they communicate what they are doing and they do it in a way that's very open and transparent so that people's trust is restored. Not that we didn't trust the operators of the buildings, it's just we weren't aware of this, right? Blissful ignorance just even a few months ago.
Yeah, no, that's true. That is true. And one last thing I want to discuss was, and maybe you've seen some of this since you're more involved on the real estate side of things, are owners and managers kind of seeing the liability or risk associated with, you know, not doing some of this, not only from just a tenant retention standpoint, but, you know, maybe even from a legal standpoint. I mean, unfortunately, we're in the age of where people can tend to go through litigation for kind of frivolous things, but, you know, are there grounds for that, or what does that kind of look like?
Sure. I mean, I think there's business risk. So we're already talking to some of our partners in the Asia Pacific region who are looking to encourage people to come back to their buildings, especially kind of big, more public buildings like shopping malls, that they have to get this right in order to encourage their clients to come back. So in the case of a shopping mall, you don't have to go there. It's not like a workplace where if you have a job and you are, you know, and you're asked to come back to work, then you pretty much have to go back to work. But shopping mall, that's a choice whether you go there or not. So they are having to really communicate what they're doing and going further in communicating and encouraging people and restoring that trust and telling the population, you know, this is a safe place to come. A safe place to gather, and these are all the ways that we're doing this. So I think that there's a business risk in that buildings are for people, right? If the people don't come to the buildings, then maybe we don't need the building. So that's a problem for all of us in the building industry. We haven't really even talked about public space, but we care obviously deeply about public space also, and I think that it's been really interesting to see the role of public space, the lack of access to public space, which follows all of the same patterns that we see other disparities following. So the lack of access to, you know, high quality public space, same map as the disparity we see in infectious disease rates and death rates and chronic disease rates and food access rates. You know, we have this big disparity in our built environment, which we haven't even touched on, which is something that we obviously care deeply about also. But I would say, as far as liability is concerned, it's too soon to know how that's going to pan out. But it is a conversation that we had been having even pre-COVID-19. I presented to a room full of lawyers about a year ago, and they were asking me, like, what is the biggest risk you see in this movement? And they were saying, is it if you don't do this? And I actually said to them, I felt like the risk was going to go very quickly from this being a business opportunity in that, by really prioritizing the health of your occupants, your tenants, your neighborhood, you know, whatever scale you're building at, it was going to go from being a positive and something that you could obviously market and increase the return on investment if you're the building owner to a negative, and that it would very quickly flip to being a liability. So both a business risk, but also potentially a legal risk if you don't provide standing desks for your employees and the evidence base is so strong around long-term sitting and its impact on overall life expectancy. Does that become a risk at some point in the same way that smoking, you know, becomes a risk, passive smoke and so on? So I think it was already heading in that direction. And I think that this has just really escalated that conversation and brought it on much faster, that it's, I think it's already gone from something that you could use to differentiate yourselves positively if you were doing this and it was a nice to have, perhaps, if you were promoting health. And, you know, Fitwell went from kind of, I think, from being something that was a nice add-on to the building, that it's now going to become an essential part of a building that you can demonstrate how you're promoting health or how you're optimizing the environment for the health of your occupants. Otherwise, it's going to be negative. So I think that's happened. I don't know. Obviously, we're still in that moment before this plays out. But that's kind of what we're seeing from our end.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. And I guess this will be my last comment. But on that same call that I had yesterday, someone mentioned that they're starting to do some research on some of the buildings that they've designed and, you know, what kind of transition would be needed and so on and so forth. And while they don't have, you know, a full spectrum of evidence just yet, what they have seen so far and what they have done is that those buildings that have undergone certification, whether it be, you know, Fitwell, WELL, LEED, are more properly positioned to make that transition much easier to develop and implement some of these strategies as opposed to maybe an existing building that didn't have it at all, especially from a cost standpoint. We talk about maybe having to do renovations or retrofits and things of that nature.
We were already seeing incredibly strong demand for specifically health and wellness coming from individuals. So even before COVID-19, employees, individual employees and individual people in residential settings were demanding and willing to move jobs, pay more, you know, really kind of use whatever leverage they had in order to put themselves in environments that were specifically optimized for their health and wellness. People were already demanding it. So that was already driving this trend. And then the other part of the puzzle is that the investment community was also already looking for investment opportunities in buildings, in businesses that were overtly meeting environmental, social, and governance metrics. And health fits under the S, under the social piece. So these two trends were already driving this kind of movement towards optimizing buildings for health, because buildings already affect health. So really optimizing them for health. So it was already happening. And I think we're going to see that accelerate now, because we, even 6 months ago, had to explain the difference between public health and medical health, like kind of individual health, evidence base around individual health outcomes and what is public health and why should individual companies, individuals care about public health. And I don't think we're going to be having to make that explanation anymore somehow.
Yeah.
So that, you know, these are these big shifts that happen where suddenly everybody's awareness has really shifted in a way that I don't think you shift back right now. You've seen the evidence of what it means for the whole population to be affected. So it'll be very interesting.
Yeah, it definitely will. And this is actually a great springboard into, I guess, part two of this podcast where we talk more about Fitwell. But until then, I definitely love the research that you all are doing and definitely enjoyed having you on the podcast today. And look forward to you in our discussion for part two.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to 3P Theory with Mike Brown. If you like our show and want to know more, check out 3ptheory.com or please leave us a review on iTunes or SoundCloud. Join us next time for more insightful knowledge on high-performance building design.